politics, and presidential persuasion.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon, in for Steve Chiatakis. Here's President Obama last night answering critics on both sides of the aisle who are voicing concern about worse-than-feared deficits. He insisted spending and recovery are inseparable.
Here's what I do know. If we don't tackle energy, if we don't improve our education system, if we don't drive down the costs of health care, if we're not making serious investments in science and technology and our infrastructure, then we won't grow 2.6%, we won't grow 2.2%. We won't grow.
On this morning after the president's news conference, the question is, did he persuade doubting Democrats? Tamara Keith reports Mr. Obama faces lingering skepticism as he lobbies for his budget on Capitol Hill today.
Budget committees in both the House and Senate are working through the president's proposals and making changes to get it all to balance out. Senate Budget Committee Chairman Kent Conrad, a North Dakota Democrat, plans to leave out of the budget any new spending for the president's proposed health care expansion. And neither House nor Senate Democrats are directly including Obama's controversial cap-and-trade system for dealing with climate change in their budgets. On the other side of the aisle, Republicans say the president's plan spends too much, borrows too much, and taxes too much. GOP Congressman from Wisconsin, Paul Ryan, laid out the political realities this morning on CNBC.
I think the tax increases are going to happen. I'd like to think we can defeat cap and trade. They're still trying to run it through. And on health care, let's not have a government takeover of 17% of our economy.
In his mind, the final ingredients in the budget will depend on where moderate, so-called blue dog Democrats, land on the issues. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Take this, you pious politicians. That would be an apt headline for an angry letter of resignation from one of those AIG executives who've been chewed over for taking big bonuses. He's biting back in today's New York Times. Company VP Jake DeSantis complains that he and most of his AIG division were in no way responsible for the transactions that brought the company down. In fact, he points out he spent long hours away from his family, agreed to an annual salary of $1, and has worked hard to dismantle the company, which he says is crucial to repaying the American taxpayer. He also argues that neither he nor his colleagues should be cheated out of agreed-to payments. In his words, any more than a plumber should be cheated after he has fixed the pipes, but a careless electrician causes a fire that burns the house down. Nevertheless, he vows to donate his bonus money to organizations helping those suffering from the economic downturn. We've got a link to that New York Times op-ed on our website, marketplace.org. Wall Street's reacting positively so far to an encouraging report on orders for big-ticket goods. The Dow is kicking things off with a gain of 1.25%. Likewise, the NASDAQ and S&P 500. A scary number out of Japan today. Picture the steep curve of a descending roller coaster, and you'll have an image of the sharp fall-off in Japanese exports. They've dropped a whopping 49% year over year. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is visiting Mexico today for 2 days of talks, as Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports from the America's Desk at WLRN. She's walking into a simmering trade war.
The U.S. promised back in 1995 to allow Mexican trucks to haul cargo into the U.S. In 2007, the Bush administration launched a pilot program allowing 100 Mexican trucks into the country. But earlier this month, the Obama administration ended that program. Economist Sidney Weintraub is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The U.S. consciously and deliberately violated an agreement it signed.
In response, Mexico imposed tariffs last week on 90 U.S. products, including cherries, dog food, and toilet paper. The tariff affects more than $2 billion in trade and hits exporters in 40 states. Eric Farnsworth is with the Council of the Americas.
The Mexicans have made very clear that the next move has to be from the United States because it's the United States that didn't implement the provisions of NAFTA like we said we would.
This dispute won't be resolved today. Secretary of State Clinton doesn't have the authority to fix a trade war. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Morning Report for Wednesday, March 25th at marketplace.org. There's word this morning that mortgage applications jumped last week. The Mortgage Bankers Association reports record low interest rates spurred a 32% surge in demand for home refinancing loans. The association predicts refinancings will more than double this year to the tune of nearly $2 trillion. As Amanda Aronchek reports, that means lots and lots of processing fees from lenders.
Back in the pre-subprime days, your broker might have offered you a competitive mortgage rate and low, low fees. But now refinancing is in such high demand, there's less incentive to lower those fees. Jay Brinkman is chief economist at the Mortgage Bankers Association. He says higher fees are good news for banks.
They make money on the volume of loans that they push through. So it should be a pretty good year then for large institutions like JP Morgan Chase and Citi and Bank of America.
Fees vary from bank to bank. So how do you know if you're getting a good deal?
The important thing is for a consumer to ask, what are those fees going to be? What are you going to charge me at closing? And so they can get a full apples-to-apples comparison.
But these days, homeowners may have a tough time getting quick refinancing. Demand is so high, banks are slow to process all requests. Still, Brinkman says, don't panic. Interest rates should stay low for a good long time. I'm Amanda Aronchik for Marketplace.
Can you imagine how many of us have sad little computers or cell phones gathering dust in the corner? Lots of us can't figure out the best way to get rid of old electronics. Today, a House committee looks into how to keep old technology out of the trash. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Caitlin Carroll has the story.
Often our old electronics end up in landfills, where toxic chemicals like lead and mercury can seep out. The EPA says this kind of trash is growing 2 to 3 times faster than any other waste, largely because no one knows what to do with it. Valerie Thomas teaches industrial engineering at Georgia Tech. She says industry's done a good job of making technology less toxic, but
there's been less progress in making products easy to recycle, and there's been really very little progress in increasing the recycling rates.
Computer recycler Willie Cade says that's because there are so many different elements in each device, from magnets to metals.
So we have to figure out a way that we can turn that kind of messy stream of equipment into some really great product.
Experts say in an ideal world, electronics would have barcodes. The devices could be tossed into smart recycling bins that would read the codes. That way, recyclers would know which parts to reuse and how. I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
The 14th annual Kick Butts Day has nothing to do with the part of your anatomy that might come to mind, but everything to do with your overall health. Students across the country will draw attention today to the health hazards associated with smoking. Advocates say even though these events help discourage teen smoking, 3,500 kids still light up for the first time every day and bring tobacco products fresh sales. Danielle Carson reports.
Students get creative for Kick Butts Day.
They stage mock funerals for the Marlboro Man.
Dan McColdrick is with the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. He says events like these have helped cut teen smoking in half in the past decade, but the decline is leveling off. These campaigns can't compete with the $13 billion tobacco companies spend on advertising. Cliff Douglas heads the Tobacco Research Network at Michigan University. He says tobacco companies sell brands like Marlboro at a discount. Plus,
they introduce an array of fruit-flavored tobacco products that appeal explicitly to new users, almost all of whom are children.
But Philip Morris spokesman Bill Phelps disputes that.
Our marketing goal is to find ways to responsibly connect our brands with adult smokers.
The House is expected to pass a bill before it adjourns next week, giving the Food and Drug Administration the authority to regulate tobacco. In Washington, I'm Danielle Carson for Marketplace.
Details of the new climate bill are emerging from Washington this week, and Congress is examining the implications of legislation designed to restrict carbon gas emissions. But how do we get other countries to do likewise? Commentator Will Wilkinson observes we may already be off to a bad start.
Last week, Energy Secretary Stephen Chu said the U.S. should be open to slapping tariffs on imports from countries that fail to implement their own carbon reduction policies. Meanwhile, China has threatened trade war if faced with carbon duties, which it says are illegal under World Trade Organization agreements. Trade restrictions tend to leave all involved poorer, making trade war a frightening prospect during an already immiserating recession. So how did we come to have the energy secretary provoking threats of mutually destructive trade sanctions? Here's how. Either all the big carbon-intensive economies reduce their emissions, or there's little chance of reducing warming. If the climate modelers are right, we'll all be better off if everyone pitches in. But each has an incentive to hold out, since countries that don't pitch in will enjoy lower energy costs and a competitive advantage in international markets. Chu rightly points out that Obama's proposed cap-and-trade scheme will put American manufacturers at a relative disadvantage. So how do we avoid this and make sure countries like China don't get a leg up? In short, we can't. There is no mechanism, no global government, to compel compliance. And it's dangerously naive to think that China, who is the world's largest owner of dollar-denominated assets, is in a weaker bargaining position than the U.S. We poke the dragon at our peril. Cap and trade is sure to raise costs for struggling American consumers, but it won't much reduce warming unless countries like China and India fall in line. Yet neither the U.S. nor Europe can just force this to happen. If we try by imposing carbon duties, we'll hurt consumers even more by raising the cost of imports and possibly start a trade war no one will win. Chu's remarks highlight the fact that cap and trade is a costly, risky gambit. But now is not the time. Suffering workers and consumers can't afford to lose again.
Will Wilkinson is a fellow at the Cato Institute. We always invite your thoughts at marketplace.org. I'm Bob Moon in Los Angeles. Thanks very much for listening.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.